127th Psalm is one of the shortest in our Bible. In all, it comprises but 5 verses. And yet so compact is the scriptural literature that even this single hymn is a composite of 2 short, terse poems. They are united only in that they depend upon the general idea that man receives his blessing. All that we have and all that we are depends upon God. The first 2 couplets suggest that for our labor to be lasting, it must be blessed by the divine. Except that the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except that the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. There is a compelling piety to this verse, and we shall return to it anon. But I should like for the moment to draw your attention to the concluding 3 stanzas of the psalm, for they deal directly with our theme of this morning, parents and children. Though children are a legacy of the Lord, the fruit of the womb is a reward. As arrows in the hands of a hero, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be put to shame when they speak with their enemies in the gates. Here is the surging joy and the deep abiding gratitude and pleasure which parents have felt in all ages and all times. Hinei nachalat Adonai banim. Truly children are a blessed legacy of the Lord. Their innocent laughter, their unself-conscious chatter is a tonic after the work-weary routine of the day. When we are frustrated by our lives, and we are burdened by the weight of our responsibilities, their simple, naive innocence, their eagerness for life, their zest, their sense that each day is an adventure, restores our joy in living, reminds us that life is truly worth the bearing. We never stand as high, as proudly, sturdily, when a child looks up at us in innocent dependence, completely confident we will meet his needs and protect him from his fears. Our heart is never so full as when there are a slender pair of arms intertwined about our neck. To live, of course, is to be bruised. To live is to become cold-eyed, suspicious, wary. Somehow the child is the alchemist of the world-weary soul. 10 minutes of his magic, a dose of his laughter, that wonderful sense of being needed and of being depended upon, and we are restored, renewed, zestful, made whole. Hinei nachalat Adonai banim. Truly children are a blessed legacy of the Lord. You and I, dear friends, are citizens of a prosaic, technically oriented, down-to-earth generation. We like to label, to define, to parse, to describe. But somehow when you have explained scientifically how each of the rays of the setting sun has been bent through the atmosphere to produce the reddish glow which we call a sunset, you have lost your instinctive appreciation of the sunset itself, its majesty, and its beauty. I'm afraid that our scientific bent, which has made so much to us in many areas, has destroyed for us the immediate enjoyment, the full enjoyment of the life which we have now, the beauty of the occasion. We often speak of having a child as if it were a triumph of human engineering. We speak of birth control, of planned parenthood, of spacing our children, of artificial insemination. It's just we drew up the design, implanted the genes, determined the child. There comes that awesome, exalting, humbling moment of birth, presence of a new life, and all of these vanities and pretensions drop away. Here is a creature of infinite capacity. We, our decisions, what part did they play? At best, we advanced or delayed the coming of the child. This is God's will. We are never so close to the sweep of the creative wisdom as at that moment when new life is suddenly on us, when we sense the ultimate mystery and the fundamental miracle. We feel ourselves part of the sweep, the surge, the thrust of the divine purpose in life. A small part, a vast, far more majestic, indeed overwhelming whole. Hinei nachalat Adonai bani. Behold, children are as legacy of the Lord. The fruit of the womb's reward. As arrows in the hands of a hunter, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. To know this poem is to recall the privilege and pride of parenthood. But to look carefully again at this poem is to sense its anachronistic quality. Its emphasis on a fecundity is almost animal. Children are a blessing. Children are a joy. Children have a way of completing and complementing the marriage. But the man today who has his quiver full of them is more likely than not to be grumbling against the obstinacy of a church that refuses to countenance birth control. Nowhere does our Bible reveal the far different quality of life, though those many generations ago, as here, in its heavy emphasis on child rearing. Children were an economic and social necessity. The more children, the more secure and the more stable the family. What is the first law of the Bible, the ultimate rule of life? God's command to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply, fill up the earth. And what is the term of God's covenant with Abraham? The Lord turns to Abraham and he says, because thou hast not withheld from me thy son, thine only son, in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that is upon the seashore. Children were an economic necessity, social security, protection. Man required sons to be the machines with which he tilled his field, to be the factors with which he managed his business, to be the protectors of home, of field, of business in an unpoliced age, to be his defense in old age and weakness. So it is not at all surprising to find Sarah turning to Abraham when she discovers that she is infertile, that she cannot have children, and saying, truly the Lord has denied me the privilege of bearing. Go in, I pray thee, my Lord, unto my handmaiden. It may be that I shall be builded up through her. May be that I shall be builded up through her. In that day, there was nothing unnatural in Sarah's statement. For she recognized that the security of the clan, that her own safety and security depended upon progeny. If God had denied her that privilege, her husband must produce children through some other woman. But now, times have changed. This is an overpopulated world. It doesn't need simply another child. Many couples today deliberately make the choice not to clutter up their careers or to burden their marriages with growing responsibilities. Children are no longer a vital necessity. Marriage no longer exists primarily to produce children, to be a baby factory. Marriage today is essentially what it should always have been if it could have been. The relationship of two adult people, a man and a woman, in love. The chance to draw apart, to build together. Intimacy. Love. Consecrated and shared life. Marriage is for lovers. Marriage is not for children. And yet, at our daughter's wedding, we toss rice, an ancient symbol of great fertility. And still today, most of our young girls rush from the marriage altar to the maternity ward, hardly hesitating to ask themselves if they really are prepared to have children. I'm afraid that far too many of us still believe that marriage is to have children. What a tragedy this sometimes is. Long before young people know each other, in fact, in many cases, long before they know themselves, they have suddenly burdened their lives with the most awesome responsibility any human being can undertake. Here is a young father. He's not even completed his education. He has no knowledge yet of which path, which business opportunity he will follow. Yet there is a child at home, and perhaps two. He is burdened with the responsibility of supporting a family. His wife can no longer share the task. How often can he make a false start? How often can he say, I will not shackle myself to this lifelong routine, which is of drudgery? Here is a young couple whose marriage has not yet solidified, settled down, set down deep roots. And they bring into their small apartment a cradle or two. And suddenly, there is no silence. There is no chance for the quiet intimacy which weaves tightly the bonds of love. Every moment of the day is preoccupied with its responsibilities. Every moment of the night is preoccupied with the responsibilities of the child. And before they have learned to love fully, to know intimately one another, their lives are being exhausted of the connubial joy. Here is a young thing who rushed into marriage to have a child and has the child, but who discovers as the years pass that she wants to complete her education. She wants to test herself against a career. Here is the child, a millstone around her neck. And I wonder how many young infants pay a terrible psychological price for the unconscious hurt such mothers impose on such millstones. There are more than 14 million children in the United States whose parents are either separated or divorced. And there are countless millions more whose homes are held together only by convention, by family and social pressure. Now, most of these youngsters will grow up to be fine citizens. But each in his own way will pay a heavy price. Some will lack the father image, the mother figure after which to model their lives. Others will build defenses in depth against ever falling in love, opening oneself to another, fearing the searing hurt which they saw in the life of their parent. You know, marriage is the only aspect of our lives in which we allow the innocent to suffer for another's mistakes. And the innocents do suffer. And yet, every year, tens of thousands of infants are born as parents make one last desperate effort to salvage a marriage. Children ought to be born when the marriage is secure and certain, stable enough to bear the burden of these responsibilities, sure enough to give love to another. No, these children are born to save the marriage, presumably, as if the child is some miracle worker who can unstop by his very presence the fountains of love, going to assuage the grievances, who all by the wave of his little hand bring joy, gladness, companionship, intimacy, and hope. Lo nivra. Such miracles do not take place. Such infants pay a terrible price for their birth. Every year in the United States, tens of thousands of children are born because their grandparents want them. Many very young people marry because they sense their suggestibility, their plasticity, that they have no will of their own sufficiently strong to stand up and to be independent of their parents. They seek the support of a husband or a wife. Your grandmother wants to have her immortality underneath. The urge to have a grandchild is one of the most compelling basic urges known to man. And this is assurance of such continuity as we can manage. We want to see our cottage. The daughter who is not yet sure that she will hear every night her husband's footsteps turn eagerly towards the house, she has no need yet to hear the little footsteps prancing in the playroom. She needs to be at home in her love, at home and home. Here is mother, father, urging her into a pregnancy for which the young couple is not yet prepared. And the child comes. It brings great joy to the grandparents. There is always somebody to drive up after a few hours of play and take the child home. To the parents, the child is a burden. The child saps at the roots and the wellsprings of their marriage. The child exhausts their energy. The child interposes himself between them. They are not yet so sure of themselves often as to be able to have this young stranger in the house. The child can bring great joy to a couple. Child can bring to people grandest, most blessed of happiness. If not, the marriage is not secure. A happy child requires a happy marriage. And a happy marriage does not require children. One of the romantic fictions of our age is that marriage is never completed until there is an infant in the house. And this is nonsense. There are many compensations to marriage. There is a quietness, a togetherness, a calmness to the home without a child. It is its own compensation. There is intimacy, an opportunity, a freedom to the home without a child, which is its own compensation. Now mistake me not. I believe in children. Mistake me not. I would not trade in my three. Most of the time. But mistake me not. The marriage which cannot bear the emotional burden of a child does well to avoid having a child. There is a great joy in a child. There is a joy, the mystic joy of sharing in creation. There is the intellectual joy of watching the child unfold. There is the joy of sacrifice. There is joy in their joy. There is great benefit of having a child. We grow into our maturity. We learn to give of ourselves without thought of reward, simply because it is right and necessary to give. A parent cannot grow sullen and bitter because the child is having a temper tantrum or is turning angrily against him and slamming the door or in his adolescent rebellion. He must be constant. Having a child anneals and hardens as we lead. Having a child teaches us the old doctrine, Sahar Mitzvah Mitzvah, reward of a good deed, the good deed itself. Children rarely say thank you. When they do, it's only because we have told them that they must do so. There's great joy, but not the only joy that is available to a marriage. The ultimate joy of a marriage is the love shared by two human beings. This growing sense of intertwinement, of death, of depth, of being one. This is a supreme joy. children. Children require the happy home. Children require a home which is sufficiently secure to sacrifice, to suffer for. Sacrifice, suffer. Hard words, I know, but chosen deliberately. The Talmud speaks always of the Tsar Gidul Bonim, of the troubles, of the anguish, of the heartache of having a child. Never of the joy, of the fondling, of the cuddling, of the cooing, but always of the trouble, of the worry, of the midnight vigils, of our hurt and their hurt, of our frustration with their fumblings, of our worry with whether they will be able to meet the mark and pass the test and measure up to life. It's true. There are great joys and compensations to having children. There is great worry, anguish, concern. Children require the sacrifice of love. Love is impulsive. The love of a parent for a child must be disciplined. A child cannot always be fondled and embraced. He must have his privacy. He must have his maturity. He must be able to turn the shoulder, turn away. Love is natural. The love of a parent for a child must be disciplined. For a child must be taught duty and responsibility and obedience and rules. Love seeks love. Love thrives on the response of love. The love of a parent for a child does not always strike a responsive chord. There will be that awful moment when the child walks away and you know in your heart of hearts that he will have to discipline himself in order to turn back, to come to call, to spend part of his adult life. Suffering, sacrifice are the responsibilities of a parent. The parent had better be secure enough in his own marriage, in himself, be capable of giving of himself to that degree. Her child requires discipline. And to discipline a child, we must risk the love of the child. You may not. Daddy, I don't love you anymore. You may not. Daddy, I won't live at home anymore. You may not. How many of us have that courage, and how often do we have that courage to risk their love, that precious love? Because we know that only if we can help them to form a conscience, to internalize rules, only then will they be able to direct their energies constructively and usefully in life. You must be prepared to risk the love of your child for the sake of your child, to take the long periods of sullen anger and silence, the slammed doors, the bitterness, the whining, complaint. Yet, if you persevere, more often than not, you will realize the child respects you for that discipline, that you have not lost the love. Dad was a tough old cuss, but you know, he really cared about you. Children require discipline. Indeed, children thrive on discipline. There is nothing more confusing, more traumatic for a child than to be blind, not to know what is required of him and by whom. A child needs to have a mark set for him. For having met that mark, he has given pleasure to those who mean the most to him, but that is his own greatest pleasure and achievement. He who loves his child, the Bible tells us, reproves him often. He who loves his child reproves him often. But there are some who mistranslate this biblical emphasis on discipline into an emphasis on rigidity and authoritarianism. This is not the biblical way. The Bible is not impressed over much with teaching and with preaching and with mottos and with maxims and with rules and with instruction through the backside. The Bible is impressed with that teaching which is done by example. Train up the child in the way that he should go and be sure you walk that way yourself. The child comes from a home where there is care in the relationships between human beings, care and courtesy. The child will come to know that care and courtesy are
instinctive and natural and proper and necessary in all human relationships. Indeed, that the care and courtesy make human relationships possible. And in time, this will become a pattern, a tie.
Never forget the essay submitted by one of our confirmands some years ago, who answered the question, what were some of the problems of growing up in the 20th century with this comment? The greatest problem we face is to learn manners without seeing. Train up the child in the way that he should go and be sure that you walk that way yourself. What is true of manners is true, called a homer, to a heightened degree. Ethics, fundamental things, issues of morality. Every home, good, bad, or indifferent, every home teaches the infinite morality. Speak the truth, don't snitch a cookie, be honest, obey the rules. Every home has rules until the child begins to notice the inconsistency between what is demanded of him and what the parents demand of themselves. Mommy, why did you tell whoever called that Daddy wasn't at home? Mommy, why don't we ever have a colored person over to a meal? Mommy, why did you and Daddy laugh happily when you talked of our neighbor's divorce, extramarital affair? Daddy, why do you praise somebody who got ahead by cunning? It's at that point that the weak home turns to the temple, and then at some parent teachers meeting or in my office, I'll hear someone say, isn't ethics the business of the congregation? Aren't you here to teach us ethics, teach my child ethics? Of course not. We teach the children of the commandments, of the basic rules and themes which have built civilization. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. You know them as well as I. And we try to relate these to the practical responsibilities of the child's life. And occasionally we can take a child and make him reach out for these grand themes, even if he has not seen them in the home. Make him sense the historical thrust, the virtue of what we teach. More often than not, when the child has heard the conventional moralities preached and seen the conventional immoralities practiced, he's long since made the judgment. What we teach here is, in his words, hot air. Irrelevant, ethereal, fine for the Sunday school, but not at all the kind of rule a person can follow everyday life. A parent must be an adult. By that I mean a parent must have a consistent philosophy of life. His belief of right and wrong, of the proper and of the inadmissible, and he must live by it. And he must show in the home, in its daily challenges, in its conversation, in his whole being. He must evidence to the child the kind of human being a decent human being can be. How do you fail a child without really trying? Buy a home in a good school district. Send him to a doctor at least twice a year to see that he's physically sound. Clothe him properly. Educate him well. Take him places. Play with him in the backyard. Read to him at night. Enjoy him. Allow him opportunity. Deny him the most important opportunity of all. A chance to see in you his most intimate neighbor, his most beloved human being, his hero or heroine, an adult, a decent, worthwhile, fine human being. That's how you fail a child. Not so much how we, what the child does, but what we do. Be a parent, you must be an adult. Be a parent, you must be an adult, and to be an adult means, dear friends, that we recognize our limitations, that we are not divine, but only mortal. Me being an adult recognizes, means that we recognize that we cannot sculpt the child after our own vision. And once all is said and done,
Once we have given the child every opportunity at our disposal, once we have been to the child as fine an example as we can possibly be, there is no guarantee the child will grow up to please us, or even to please himself. The rabbis often commented on the verse in Genesis which describes the early life of the twins, Jacob and Esau. And the boys grew up, Vayigdalu habanim, and Esau was a cunning man, a man of the wild. Jacob was a quiet man, a man of the tent. Vayigdalu habanim, the rabbi said, the children grew up means that they had the same parents, they enjoyed the same love, they enjoyed the same opportunity, they had the same tutors, all was done for them identically. Yet Esau grew up to be a wild youngster, a cunning man. Jacob grew up more mature, quiet, a man who was disciplined to the community. There are prodigals in the best-run homes. The apple does fall sometimes quite a distance from the tree. So we return to the psalm with which we began. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build. All is said and done. And as parents, we have exhausted our understanding, given of our love, sought to live decently as fine examples. And all is said and done, we must throw our faith on God. Ask his support. Ask him to light the fire of learning within our youngster. Ask him to light the fire of self-discipline within our youngster. Ask him to light the fire of responsibility within the young person. Ask God's help. We are with him, partners in this journey. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build. You need mazel. You need good luck with your children. Beyond good luck, you need adults. Maturity, responsibility, sense of your own worth, consistency in your own life, decency in the very private parts of your own life. With these, with God's help, we will each of us raise our children as best we can, someday speak to one another how to fail as a grandparent without really trying. Amen.